Welcome to a podcast of Impossible Things, as we discuss episode 4 of William Hartnell classic, The Aztecs. I'm Caleb Woodbridge.
I'm Peter Bell.
I'm Swithin Dobson.
And I'm James Willett.
We've watched the first three episodes, and how are you looking forward to the fourth?
It's all obviously coming to a head, which is what you'd hope for, for the final episode. But as we discussed at the end of the last episode, we've had our first sort of what would now be considered proper cliffhanger, with one of our characters in immediate peril, and quite an interesting one, actually. We've got Ian trapped inside this flooding tunnel. Quite why it's flooding halfway up an Aztec pyramid is beyond me.
But it's just a classic villain device, yeah, isn't it? Flooding chamber.
Secret passage and then yeah. Flooding chamber.
Flooding, yes.
He did look remarkably worried despite the fact that his toes were getting slightly splashed. But, yeah, nevertheless, we got the gist of it. So, no, but again, we were discussing last week how all of the separate threads and all the little mini subplots which have been sort of scattered around are finally starting to interweave and beginning to pay off, and I'm looking forward to this episode.
James?
Yeah, I'm also looking forward to it. I'm just really looking forward to seeing how it all wraps up. This being my first classic episode, obviously it's all completely new for me, and I just kind of, I want to see how it's done differently to the newer episodes, where this would be the cue for some really over-the-top special effects, and maybe the plot will just completely ignore what's gone before.
William Hartnell goes all glowy.
Yeah.
Waves the sort of screwdriver.
Yeah, exactly.
The Aztecs all leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to see how it's wrapped up again, because I don't remember it that well. And, as James was saying, it's quite interesting to see how different, it's kind of differently wrapped up than it had them kind of previously. Well, in the new series. So
not previously.
On X-Men, no.
So, should we carry on and hit the play button on episode 4, The Day of Darkness?
Here we go. As well as Ian being trapped in the flooded tunnel, we also have, I think, possibly the only time this has ever happened in Doctor Who history, two of our main characters in imminent peril of marriage. One of them perhaps slightly more willingly than the other. I know William Hartnell is playing hard to get.
I think they ought to have that threat more often in the new series.
Yeah.
Imminent threat of marriage.
Some Margaret Slavine comes back, decides that she likes the look of the Doctor in his new David Tennant form, and
tries to marry him.
It could be like a big episode of Pepe Le Pew with David Tennant being chased across Cardiff by Margaret Slavine.
The mind boggles after that romantic meal out.
Well, there you go.
It's the natural sequel.
It starts with dinner in bondage, and
they've already laid the groundwork.
So we have the cliffhanger resolution. A few volts of
very convenient
getting out of the way. It's always useful.
It's a trapdoor above.
Swithin and I were complaining about the convenient trapdoor get out when we were watching Stephen Moffat's episodes in Series 4, but it has precedent, obviously. How am I going to escape the flooded tunnel? I'll just use the door.
Yeah. the one that's above me, that.
Oh, come on, it's nearly as good as a square skin as well. So, oh, yeah, how are we going to get away? Oh, just fire something if it's warm, get out.
Interesting how similar Ian's little pen torch was to an actual sonic screwdriver.
Yeah, because it was more of a torch kind of device, it looked like originally. Originally came in, was it?
Fury for the Deep was the first story. Although some of the target, I think the target novelisation of the War Machines anachronistically has William Hartnell using the sonic screwdriver. Oh, the first Doctor.
Right. But what has he done?
Well,
he's found a secret passage into the tomb where they arrived.
Knew that. In the first. That's the reason why he went up.
Ah, yeah.
So, I don't think it's as bad as the trapdoor in the Forest of the Dead.
That's true, actually.
Because he's got his purpose. He's looking
for. We're looking for the way in.
See, we couldn't get him out of that one.
It has been set up. And, yes.
And the stuff.
The more I see Ian in these Aztec warrior clothes, the more I agree with James that they really do look like the flight suits from the original Battlestar. Is it too much to ask to have a tomb full of original Cylon Centurions?
Yeah.
That would be so cool.
Tomb of the Cylons.
Yeah. It even sounds like a Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
It should have been made.
Something,
there's
something.
A crossover waiting to happen.
Yeah, the Cybermen versus the Cylons.
We've got some comic books area, isn't it? Now?
Yeah.
Like, let's get everybody. It gets everybody else.
Okay, the Cylons were the only things missing from the last series finale, really, weren't they?
Yeah.
We have the Death Star. We have the Dark.
That's all right. We've got a Christmas special coming up. I'm sure that'll.
That's true. A very Cybermen Christmas.
Yeah. What's better, we get Camp Cybermen?
Oop, hide behind the chair. So
we actually have a reason now for Ian to bear a grudge against the warrior that he's supposed to be fighting. The fact that he cheated in the battle.
He's British and takes some shit.
Yeah. But he could excuse it simply because it's the Doctor who told him to cheat.
Because, with Ian Chesterton, he is the fairly conventional main man hero type character.
Mm. He came.
He's the everyman.
He did something with ITV before this, didn't he?
Oh yeah.
Didn't he play Lancelot in?
I think dramatization.
Yeah, that was at the ITV thing, and it was kind of classic kind of hero.
Just some of the inflections are quite nice. I think how it's like Yan. Great hug, so thanks you.
He really just wants to be in Shakespeare, doesn't he?
Mm.
I think he'd make a good Shylock. Merchant of Venice.
But going back to Caleb's point about Ian being the everyman. He was a workaday hero. It was one of the things that really struck me when I first watched An Unearthly Child and the Daleks. Just how much of an ensemble piece it was.
Yeah.
Ian is effectively the focus of the story.
Well, yeah.
In many places.
And with the novelisation of Doctor Who and the Daleks, or as it's titled, Doctor Who and an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, it's written as a first-person narrative from Ian's point of view.
Ah, yes, and didn't...
An interesting choice by David Whittaker, who novelised it.
Ah, and didn't... what's his name, who plays Ian? I forget the name off the top of my head.
William Russell.
William Russell. Didn't he actually narrate the audio version of the novelisation?
He might have done. He's done interlinking narration for the audio tracks.
It's apparently very, very good and quite gritty, and starts with Ian lost in a kind of fog-bound London, stumbling across the TARDIS.
Yeah, it's a different version of events from An Unearthly Child. Mm. It gives a different... it's interesting because I read Campaign by Jim Mortimer, a past Doctor Adventure that got dropped by the BBC because it was delivered late and was very different from the original outline, to say the least. But it was pitched as a straightforward historical, but it has multiple realities and stuff, and you're not quite sure what's going on. It plays on some of the different versions of the First Doctor and his companions, because obviously you have the TV version, but also the annuals and the novelizations and the Dalek movies, and you've got different variations.
In that speech there, actually, we've just missed a strike him down, which actually is very Emperor from Star Wars. Like,
strike him down!
Yes!
Yes! You didn't have your tats and looking as if he's going to enjoy every second.
Yeah.
Is it my imagination, or has the lighting of the exterior portion of this throne room set changed slightly? Because while the throne room itself still looks fantastic, those shots where you do get the panorama out over the city, it's very obviously a back cloth.
Yeah,
I don't know. Perhaps we are watching on a different television, so I don't know whether that has an effect.
I would have thought it would have been more noticeable on your TV, which should have a slightly crisper image. I would have thought it would pick at any inconsistency.
Oh,
far more.
Oh, here we go. The framing. A classic technique, the framing of your enemy.
But this normally happens within the first 10 minutes of episode one. It's unusual for them to leave it this late.
Don't answer the awkward question.
No. Ooh. We've got the change in Autwatt now.
Yeah.
From implacable defender of the Guardi Dax, so it's now kind of wavering.
They're one sort of real allies now. Working against them.
More cunning plans.
Yeah. He's getting an awful lot of screen time, which is no bad thing at all. They are making the most of one of their best guest cars.
I'm making a wheel, which apparently the Aztecs didn't have. So that's quite interesting. Before, when they were trying to open the tomb entrances, they were essentially trying to use as much leverage as possible without using a pulley, which is quite interesting. The way of trying to get out of the place. It was trying to, like, you know, there's no wheels to use. There wasn't any around. So it's like, that's quite a bit different, I suppose, then.
Although
the screwdriver.
The fact that the door obviously pivots on something in the first place suggests that there's a wheel in the mechanism somewhere.
There's probably like a... Well, if it is, it'd be a very small kind of hinge. Mm. Yeah, it could be hinged like that at the door, but vertically.
That's true.
Obviously, they would have had round things, which is not the big round things.
I believe he's thin. He's, isn't he? He's extremely thin. We've just realised that there is practically nothing to Ortlock at all.
He really can't.
He's standing next to Barbara, and I think Barbara has a bit more width and shape to her than he does.
Yeah, this is today. It'd be on, you know, bad influence, you know? or you know, size minus two.
He's not... It's not exactly like he's some kind of aspirational symbol.
Yeah,
or
anything. All these kids going, "Mummy, when I grow up, I want to be an Aztec priest."
Well, to make society slightly more interesting than it is at present.
Did anyone else cover the Aztecs in history at school, by the way?
No.
I just want to check. No, I never did. And they tempted us when we first started with, oh, history is going to be a fabulous subject to study. We're going to do all these interesting things. And we just did an endless line of kings and queens.
And the Battle of Britain?
We didn't even do the Battle of Britain. We did World War I and World War II at the same time.
Okay. So it was the same war, wasn't it?
Just with a bit of a gap in between.
Yeah, an awful lot of us ended up slightly confused as to what happened in which war. Simply because we were fighting the same people in the same places, but with differing techniques and differing amounts of success.
Yeah.
And then...
I remember doing the Romans and the Celts.
Oh, we know.
And Egyptians in primary school.
Oh, we never did them. We just did the Industrial Revolution every year.
Did that in year 8 or year 9. In secondary school we did British history with a particular emphasis on Welsh history.
I'd love to have done Welsh history.
1066 onwards,
basically.
So we did the Norman invasion, and then we jumped, Llywelyn, the last Prince of Wales, Owain Glyndwr, and then straight to the Tudors.
I feel like going back in time and demanding to have my childhood over again. Simply because we really naff history subjects. We did, from the age of about 7, we did half a year on the canals.
Oh, canals are great. Birmingham's got more canals than Venice.
Yeah, but if you drink the water, you get cholera, which is what you say about
very,
Venice.
Very, very, very scarce in Newport. We didn't even do the history of Newport. Which has a fascinating history. You've got the Chartist uprising, you have...
I would just have loved to have done something like cavemen and dinosaurs and stuff. You never get that.
That's what I wanted to do.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's difficult because it's all archaeological based and there's no written records. Well, very little.
Because with some of the historical stuff, they did pick quite off the beaten track topics, like the massacre, for example, because the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, in which the
Catholics massacre the Huguenots.
Yeah, in France. That's not exactly top of the historical chart.
And then Robespierre's Reign of Terror as well, which is kind of reasonably up there, but still not the big. Still not.
I remember doing the French Revolution in year 9. We got put in groups.
I didn't do the French Revolution until I was in university studying French history.
We got put in groups and we had to pick a. I think we had a choice of revolutions to do: American Revolution, French Revolution, or Russian Revolution.
That's a bit unfair. The American Revolution was completely different to both the French and the Russians. Mm. Even though the French and Russians are very, very similar, from my thing. So that's slightly naughty putting them together.
But the French did have a very big part to play in the American Revolution.
You can compare the differences between them. Particularly. But with the French Revolution, we had to do a big poster, I think, as a group, and we also had to do a sketch. And the first sketch just was us, we put some chairs up to be the Bastille, and some of us were peasants and ran around a lot and chased a couple of people who were the king and queen. And the history teacher...
We never even got to do that in university.
And the history teacher complained that saw us practicing this and thought there wasn't much historical content in it. So went completely over the top and made it so that the peasants had sort of, whereas before the line would be something like, "Ah, get the king, kill that Mary Antoinette," it'd be like, "Ah, we are tired of there being free estates within French society, two privileged, one underprivileged, blah de blah de blah de blah de blah, get the king." But the history teacher loved it. It works for comedy effect, just having everyone stop to make these.
The one bit of history that I remember enjoying at school, and it was primary school, was Dick Turpin and Highwaymen. Mm. And we had to write a story about Highwaymen. And I wrote my first ever Doctor Who adventure, where Sylvester McCoy and Ace travel back in time and are chased by Dick Turpin. But they, anachronistically, they had K-9 with them. The Doctor built a new version of K-9 to travel with him and Ace, because I thought K-9 was cool. I'd only ever learned of him from the Target novelisation, but he ended up shooting Dick Turpin through the head.
But,
it's not entirely accurate as history goes. But I did get some, I'm not sure if it was a gold star, but I got some sort of star for it.
But, Doctor Who's approach to history has owed at least as much to popular literature as it has to actual history, the sort of adventure stories, that kind of genre.
Meanwhile, back at the Aztecs.
Historical digression.
Yeah. If you are still following with the DVD.
We are still watching.
Yes. I've lost all track
Kamika just... was it Kamika?
Yeah.
Just came and talked to the doctor, and now it's been discovered that is it Ixter's been cloppered?
Oh. No, that's Ixter's practicing.
I think it was the guard who was guarding.
That's it. They've got them out.
And they framed him for having stolen something, and so now he's been killed, or for just incompetence.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, getting ready to make their escape. And the doctor's made a wheeled pulley thing.
To open the...
It's nice that they're actually making a return to the TARDIS and an escape, an actual part of the plot, because normally it's... I think we were discussing this in a previous episode.
Let's save the day, and then the TARDIS will become available to us.
To me, the TARDIS is isolated because...
It's kind of a case of... Yeah, we could stay really quite easily if we want. We could go really easy, if we really wanted to. But no, we're a nice hero and we'll save people.
Mm.
Oh. I'll just change to videotape. Because Ian's got dressed as
Ian is now disguised as the guy.
Why can't Ian just kill that guy? If he can beat up, the best soldiers that...
this is the escape attempt. I do like the fact that there is no particular plan to oust the villain or anything. It is, we're just going to get away.
Here we go. Pitch battle at the end.
It's a nice... You've got that nice panoramic feel again, down on...
Yeah, it's a different shot. Yeah. I've not had this angle before.
Now that we are up, ostensibly at the top of the pyramid, you've got a high shot looking down over the stairs.
Mm. Nice painted backdrop.
Yeah. Although, from what I can remember of the making of feature of this episode, there are some bits where the restoration team have digitally painted in.
Yeah.
Ah, no, there we are. We see the back of the edge of the set.
Yeah, they kind of filled in the gaps. You couldn't really see them the first time round. It's too fuzzy.
Mm. But nicely set is all the same.
Mm.
Oh, here we go. Getting up to the classic ending.
It's a good set piece for the end.
Yeah.
And that's the end of him.
That music's a bit...
Yeah. It's a little cheery, isn't it? Hooray! Ian's cool guy.
Yeah. Rock on.
Though he sort of makes him... They don't make him kill him directly.
No, that's true.
It reminds me of the Tatooine music from...
from Star Wars.
A New Hope.
And they're going to carry on with the sacrifice.
There we are.
Nice stock footage there of an eclipse. Total solar, because obviously every time you get one, it's always total.
It did happen very quickly.
This is something we were saying before, this would not happen in the new series. The Doctor would change the society like that.
Or would at least oust the villain, or get him to question his values. But here, we're clearly told, it's even the villain is saying, yes, victory is mine.
You go, Bob, here, lamenting the fact you can change the sacrificial system.
You found another case. Professor, that's the good you've done. You failed to save a civilization, but at least you helped one man.
That's a key line. They didn't save a civilization, but they saved one man.
This is true.
Yeah, it's an interesting ending.
It does raise the question, does the civilization need saving particularly, or does one of the central tenets of the faith need changing? Because the civilization as a whole isn't, as has been shown, not to be a bad one particularly.
I think it's one good thing regarding having to set it, because sort of like an Earth-based historical period, is you can't really get away with changing things wholesale, which is kind of an alien culture.
That's true.
Again, the planet of the Ood. An example. With this.
And we have the cliffhanger into the next episode, as was the custom, as we run together.
Because you're right.
James, this is your first view of the inside of the classic TARDIS.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Strangers in space.
What's this? Is this the Keys of Mariners?
I'm not entirely sure. What follows this comic?
I think it's the Keys of Mariners. Yeah. I think so. But yeah, inside of the TARDIS. What do you reckon?
Yeah. Here we are.
Of the inside of the TARDIS, it looked like it was made more of junk than
it effectively was.
Yeah. Like, there seemed to be a few common household implements just thrown in there.
The randles in the wall are actually a photograph of the back of an old packet of aspirin, with the aspirin taken out and then blown up to enormous proportions.
There you go.
It really was made out of bits and pieces lying around.
Yeah.
But far more, I mean, you didn't see much of it there, but especially in the early episodes, like Edge of Destruction in particular, it's far more of a science lab. You know, you've got different sectors to the inside of the TARDIS. You've got the central panel, but you have a little living quarter, you have a...
It has like an artificial food making machine, which is not referenced later on in stories when you need water, such as in Marco Polo.
You have these little pull-down beds that come out of the wall. You have, and you do have just a big bank of computers built into one wall to help to control the flight.
More extensive than the present. I think so. We have finished our first fantasy series story, and what does everybody think? We should start with James.
I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good.
Convert.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing some more.
we'll show him the horns of 9 months.
No, I was going to do Time Lash.
The Trial of a Time Lord box set from start.
That'd be an awesome idea. Instead of doing Torchwood Marathon, we do Trial of a Time Lord Marathon.
If you want to get an idea of what Time Lash is, like, work out what it's an anagram of.
We'll leave that. This is your homework for the next one.
Yeah. Yeah, but you were saying, sorry, after that.
I enjoyed it very much. It's just so different to the new series that, in a way, it's a completely different program, I suppose. Yeah. The key things are there, but I suppose just in the same way that the Doctor himself changes, you know, person to person, the actual vibe of the show is completely different. And I don't know if that does change at all throughout the...
Yeah, well, as we watch, hopefully, much more classic series stuff, you do see how it develops into, what it later becomes, and it'd be interesting because the roots of it does develop a lot, and so there's continuity between the new series and the old. You can see particularly in the later 80s and sort of more of an emphasis on Earth and the Doctor's companions as characters, like with Ace in particular. You can see the sort of seeds of the later show, and also the more action adventure, the Doctor becoming more of a action hero from Peter Davison's probably the first one. Well, perhaps John Pertwee in some ways.
Yeah.
I think I liked it as well because it didn't feel the need to go over the top with the Doctor's a genius, he can solve all this and here's this great big explanation. It was content to let the plot be what it was, that they were trapped outside and that all this stuff was going on around them. And that you didn't need anything more than that.
Mm.
Whereas a lot of time, I mean, now in these new series you'll get that kind of thing, and then we'll have, and here's, you know, well, going back to the Pompeii one, here's some people building a giant computer out of rock, and now there's some monsters and they've all got visions, and you know, it just wasn't like that. It was just, here's a civilization, here's a little bit about it, now what we're going to do with it.
It was about the culture shock.
Yeah, really, exactly. It? Not, you know, monsters and really intricate plots that failed to resolve themselves very well.
Yeah, and we get ourselves out by making ourselves a pulley. Yeah. As opposed to saying abracadabra.
Yeah, exactly. Or just zapping it with a sonic screwdriver.
Half an episode whittling. This is our escape plan.
Yeah,
which has such remarkable simplicity to it, really.
Yeah, but it's something that does make sense within the setup of the story, just within Aztec culture, it works within that context, and it's a logical development within the story. So it does sound quite funny. The Doctor wins by building a pulley, but it does work.
I must admit, I was very impressed. I have seen the Aztecs before, but not for some years, so it wasn't particularly fresh in my mind. And the more I see of the original TARDIS crew, the more I like them. I mean, the group dynamic works very well.
Yeah.
Admittedly, in this case, Susan was sidelined for a lot of it. But just the characters, the ordinariness, there's a certain honesty to the characters. There's less pretension, I think.
Yeah, in fact, they didn't really want to be there in the first place.
Yes, this is true. They're all in it together, aren't they? They're all in the same boat.
They've lumped it together, victims of circumstance. Mm.
And they ended up quite humbled by the end of it, which, going back to what James said, doesn't really happen an awful lot anymore. The Doctor goes in knowing almost everything about the situation and is able to solve it in most cases. Whereas here they solve absolutely nothing. I'm just lucky to get away.
Well, that was in the middle, wasn't it? The Doctor didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was kind of a more similar style thing. This, obviously, we had the kind of the combat ending in midnight, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you do lose something when the Doctor, wherever they turn up in history, the Doctor already knows about it. It does lose that sense of exploration and coming back to the exploration versus tourism thing we've discussed before. And when he comes up against monsters, I mean, you can understand it in the 45-minute episode why they do it for just to get things moving.
Yeah.
But it does make things less interesting if whenever the monster turns up, the Doctor's like, I know who these are, Krillitane, or whatever. And it is when the Doctor becomes near omniscient, it does lose something.
Hmm. Yes.
Yeah, well, there we go. No, as I say, I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
It was very good indeed.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to watching and commenting on some more classic serials, hopefully.
Yeah, but we'll...
in months to come.
Yes, next we'll be doing a couple more of the new series.
Yes. Due to popular demand, we have been getting plenty of emails and comments and things on our Facebook group about this. We are going back to the beginning of the new series, Christopher Eccleston era. We've already done episode 1, Rose, and so we're going to be working our way through the remainder of series 1 over the months to come.
Yeah, alternating with classic series stuff.
Yeah, indeed.
And with a few extras, like we've got a Big Finish special. The Sarah Jane Adventures will be starting shortly, so we hope to cover some of that.
So it's going to be a very busy period ahead. If you do have any particular requests or comments, then really please do get in touch with us, because we do like hearing from you.
Yeah, if you so the next couple of episodes will be The End of the World and Lone Quiet Dead. So if you've got any comments, if you want to email them in, or even record yourself and send it to us as an MP3 so we can play your comments as part of the show, then get in contact with us on the usual address, impossiblepodcast@gmail.com.
That's it for now, I think, isn't it, guys?
See you next week.
Bye.
Thank you, faithful listeners.